The Crimopedia podcast is a completely independent show that explores content of a potentially violent and disturbing nature. Please use your listening discretion. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Crimopedia podcast. Today, I want to talk to you about a case that went unsolved for 27 years. With ever-evolving advances in DNA technology, manifestations of those advancements in forensics, and smart police work, which we don't see quite as often as we would like, means that cases such as the abduction and murder of Jacob Wetterling can get closure. I wouldn't be telling the whole truth if I only credited science, however, because the resolution of Jacob's case really came from a combination of unwavering community support, some savvy online amateur sleuthing, and a knack for old criminal habits to die hard. With that, we're heading on over to the United States, to the state of Minnesota, back in 1989. Let's jump right in. Eleven-year-old Jacob Wetterling is often described in articles as mature, quote, wise beyond his years. He was friendly, he was warm, and he was welcoming to all who knew him. It may be that little Jacob was raised in a loving household made up of his two parents, Patty and Jerry Wetterling, as well as two younger siblings, Trevor and Carmen, who all reciprocated their love for each other in a warm and welcoming household. It may also be because the Wetterlings lived what reads as a picturesque life in rural Minnesota. According to the 2020 census, Long Prairie, Minnesota, where the family originally resided, has a population of almost 3,700, which doesn't seem to have changed all that much over the years. Long Prairie and the surrounding towns are pretty much all the same. The most extravagant hotels that you'll find are inns, small water bodies are accessible by foot for community residents, and there's often only one or possibly two intersecting main streets. In places in Minnesota like Long Prairie or St. Joseph, it's commonplace for kids in the town to ride around on their bicycles at will, a be home before the streetlights come on type of atmosphere. If you grew up in one of these small towns, the friends you made were likely the ones that you had for life, and their parents were likely your friends' parents too. This was certainly the life it seems that Jacob Wetterling was living. The community he lived in was close-knit, folks could rely on each other, and after school, him and his friends mostly spent their time outside, even in the colder months. This is exactly what he was doing on the evening of October 22nd, 1989. On this evening, nearing Halloween back in 89, Patty and Jerry Wetterling were at a dinner party away from home. 11-year-old Jacob, his 10-year-old brother Trevor, and their little baby sister Carmen were at home. With the boys hanging out was Jacob's friend Aaron, who was the same age as Jacob. He was also 11. That evening, the boys were hanging out at the Wetterling household, and as the evening went on and they were watching over Carmen, they got the idea to head down to the local convenience store to rent a movie to watch. At a time before streaming services, this meant that Jacob, Aaron, and Trevor were all intending to get on their bikes and sort through whatever selection of physical VHS tapes were available in the store. However, ultimately, although this was a commonplace activity, they were still kids, and they were still watching Carmen, and so before they left the house, they had to ask Jacob's parents. So, Jacob Wetterling grabbed his home phone and got a hold of his mom, Patty, whom he asked if they could ride down to the store, again with the intention of renting a movie. Reportedly, Patty said no, as the sun had long set at this point, and the boys could not just leave little Carmen at the house by herself. However, insistent on finding a way to get their hands on a movie, the boys got creative, employing a classic tactic that we all used as kids, and I'm sure we all thought we invented at the time. If mom says no, call dad. Jacob Wetterling then rang his father, and instead of waiting on him to give the same reply that Patty did, he informed his dad that he'd promised to wear a reflective vest and use flashlights given the darkness outside, and that he would ask the 14-year-old neighbor next door to watch Carmen while they were out at the store. After all, that's what community is for. Jerry then let the boys know that this plan, in all things considered, was fine. And so just after 9 p.m. on that day, the three boys set out on their bikes to the local Tom Thumb convenience store in St. Joseph, a nearby town along 91st Avenue, also called 16th Avenue Southeast. The three boys arrived at the convenience store in time to get their hands on a copy of the movie The Naked Gun, and before long ventured back to Jacob and Trevor's house altogether. However, not long before the group reached the house, along 16th Avenue, a man wearing a balaclava-like mask emerged in front of the group, armed with a revolver. This man stopped the three boys on their bikes, flashing his gun, and ordered them to dismount and lay down on the ground, face down, in a ditch. Once the boys were lying face down, the man then asked all three of them what their ages were, starting with Trevor, Jacob's brother. Trevor replied to the man that he was 10 years old, to which the man promptly instructed Trevor to get up and run in the direction of a nearby wooded area without ever looking backwards, going as far as he could, or else he would be shot. Once Trevor was far enough away, the man then ordered Jacob and Aaron, the two remaining boys, to stand up and face him. When they did, the man looked at them before ordering Aaron to do the same as Trevor, run toward the same wooded area and do not look back, or else he'd shoot. Once Aaron was finally out of sight, so was Jacob and his abductor, and this would be the last time Jacob Wetterling was ever seen alive. Eventually, Aaron and Trevor were able to find each other. It's unclear if that happened in the wooded area they were instructed to run towards, or if it was back at the Wetterling house where they met, but regardless, they were safe, and as soon as they did reach Jacob's house, police were notified. Within minutes, police from the Stearns County Sheriff's Office responded to the scene. However, despite their timely response, officers could not find a trace of Jacob or his abductor anywhere nearby where the boys claimed they had been ambushed. Nobody in the community could have known this at the time, but contrary to their thoughts, according to Stearns County Sheriff John Sanner, who claimed, quote, "Everybody thought that within a few hours it would get taken care of, 11-year-old Jacob would remain missing for 27 years. The abduction of Jacob Wetterling struck the surrounding community hard, and the collective grief shared by those nearby rippled throughout the state of Minnesota and eventually throughout the country. Kids in the nearby area who had previously enjoyed summers outside under the shared watch of a community who normally looked out for each other, no questions asked, suddenly felt uneasy. In an interview of Jacob's old classmates that took place years later in 2016, the former students who knew Jacob personally relayed the shock and fear felt by many. One student recalled feeling lost and confused about the ordeal, unable to comprehend or really process the gravity of Jacob's abduction, being occupied with concern about Jacob having Halloween candy to return to when he got back from wherever he was. Another student reported feeling scared to venture to a nearby wooded area surrounding her home, one presumably she had ventured to many times, which was a common sentiment shared amongst kids in the rural community. As neighbors, friends, and loved ones struggled to grapple with such a senseless and seemingly random attack, law enforcement sprung into action. The same night of Jacob's disappearance, firefighters and approximately 35 officers from the Stearns County Sheriff's Office began their ground searches. Almost immediately in tandem, two agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation and five from the nearby Minneapolis Police Department were assigned to the case. In addition, a command post was set up in St. Joseph for officers to work out of and community members to go to offer information. However, despite various forms of immediate action being taken to find Jacob safely, the searches were unsuccessful and were called off at 3 in the morning to resume the next day. And promptly resume they certainly did. On October 23rd, teams of search parties departed around 8 a.m. to conduct ground searches with help from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, who supplied all-terrain vehicles for a 2-mile search radius. While they were on the ground, helicopters were in the air, instructed to cover a 25-square-mile radius, and for those not in the United States, that's about 65 square kilometers being searched from the sky. One of the most meaningful findings of the day were a set of tire tracks which were signaled to by a bloodhound canine assisting with the search. This led police to believe that the kidnapper had used a car that was nearby but not seen by the surviving boys, which this made sense, as the man who kidnapped Jacob seemingly appeared out of nowhere and was gone about as quickly as he arrived. While this information was being processed and further searches were still underway, by mid-afternoon, flyers depicting Jacob's face, description, and both his family and the police's contact information were being distributed. As the second day after Jacob's abduction came to a close, the FBI decided to send out 15 more agents to assist in the investigation, including a psychological profiler. If you're not already familiar, according to the FBI's own website, profiling, now referred to as behavioral analysis, uses, quote, cutting-edge psychological research and operational experience to better understand criminal behavior and assist in solving cases. According to them, quote, experts in the FBI's behavioral analysis units work a variety of cases across the country, from terrorism to cybercrime to violent crimes against children and adults. The work includes criminal investigative analysis, interview strategies, investigative strategies, and threat assessments. And these people are responsible for supporting local law enforcement and communities in solving these types of cases. What I'm trying to get at here is that as soon as Jacob went missing, every law enforcement agency who was willing and able effectively agreed to throw the kitchen sink at this case. And still, they found nothing. Back at the command post, all while searches are going on, authorities are receiving and following up on tips that are continuously coming in. One tip received on October 25th indicated to police that a small red car had been seen in the area frequently over the previous 3 weeks, and it seemed to be unrecognized by residents in the area. Statements like this seem to have some credibility behind them, especially in small towns. Not only does everybody know each other, but they also know each other's business, including everything from what car you drive to who is arguing in the middle of your friend group. So as a result, about 24 cars in the area that vaguely matched the description were investigated, but unfortunately, to no avail. However, a glimmer of hope emerged when that FBI profiler I talked about was ready to announce the profile that he had created of the suspect to assist in the investigation. The FBI profiled the suspect to likely be a white male, ranging in age from 25 to 35, and this person was likely employed at a quote-unquote low-skilled job. The suspect was thought to have low self-esteem and a low sense of self-image, likely stemming from a physical deformity such as bad acne or scarring. Although this profile didn't lead to the immediate identification of a key suspect, information such as the profile and pleas for information from the public about tips such as the one about the red car always led to a massive influx of more tips. By the 26th of October, only a few days after Jacob had went missing, approximately 50 uniformed police officers and 20 agents from the FBI were responsible for sifting through all of them, because there was tons. All the while, more and more help continued to be recruited for ground searches, including approximately 30 officers on horseback. Although every officer involved was unwaveringly dedicated to solving Jacob's case and finding him safely, undoubtedly they were all intimately familiar with the likelihood of Jacob being alive after this many consecutive days without finding him. As law enforcement officers were aware of what the statistics about child abduction say each year, about how anywhere from 75 to 90% of children abducted were murdered within the first 24 hours, with most occurring within the first hour, they knew that consequently the odds were growing increasingly grim with each passing day that they would find Jacob alive. But even still, the police did not halt their efforts, and even if they felt moments of uncertainty or doubt, the community support was unwavering and lifted everybody back up. Within a few days of Jacob disappearing, a $100,000 reward was offered for Jacob's safe return within 72 hours, and it was raised by a local show called A Current Affair, which continued to broadcast reports on the abduction. Even if police weren't getting as far as they would have liked to, certainly the suspect must have been feeling hot by now. By October 27th, law enforcement released the first composite sketch of a man believed to be involved in the abduction of another young boy from a nearby area earlier that year. In believing the two incidents could possibly be related, police were hoping that the sketch would prompt the community to come forward with information. Although it certainly did that, and hundreds of tips continued to pour in, none were leading to anywhere viable, nor was any evidence continued to be collected during ongoing ground searches worth anything in the end. On the 28th, The most exciting piece of news was that a white sock was found about 100 yards away from where Jacob was kidnapped. But even still, none of the canines assisting in these searches could trace Jacob's scent further than the nearby road, which, if anything, only substantiated the presence of a car being involved in the abduction, meaning Jacob, if he is alive, could be really anywhere by now. By the 29th, roadblocks were set up around St. Joseph, with police hoping to encounter the suspect if he was still nearby, and although they stopped and questioned about 2,000 motorists, nothing came of it. By the 3rd of November, they'd completed over 100 formal interviews with potential persons of interest, and again, nothing. By this time, the expiration on the $100,000 reward had come and gone, and an additional $25,000 was added by Crime Stoppers and was still valid, but even that wasn't bringing in any leads. And at this point, authorities were losing hope that ground searches would turn up anything of value relative to the amount of manpower going into them. So, a final ground search was conducted on the 3rd, and investigators decided to refocus and recenter their efforts on the information they had already collected. With over 100 interviews, 2,000 motorist stops, and approximately 12,000 tips to sort through and dozens of potential persons of interest still, maybe a more detailed review of what they already had would be helpful, I'm presuming they thought. Over the coming days, police released another sketch of a different vehicle, which was linked in a different abduction of a 10-year-old boy, and three more sketches of potential suspects. These sketches were typically born from individuals reporting similar cases or attempted similar cases to Jacob's in the area, understanding that the abduction of Jacob Wetterling was likely not this man's first offense given his organization about it. He already had a plan that he was able to execute, really without hassle. And so it made sense that the police and the FBI were looking for previous incidents of a similar nature to get a lead. However, as was the nature of Jacob's case, they couldn't come up with anything concrete, and the case went cold. Weeks turned into months, turned into years of waiting for Jacob to arrive back home safe. Although the family really couldn't do anything more on the investigative front, they turned their anguish into advocacy to help cope with the loss of their son. The Wetterlings began rallying for legislated child protection. They could see clear as anyone how legal loopholes and investigative faults allowed Jacob's abductor to get away with what he had done for so long. And so the Wetterlings, if not able to go out and physically continue searching for their son themselves, wanted to do something about it to protect others in the future. As a result, as of May 1991, United States Senator Dave Durenberger proposed a national registry of people who have committed crimes against children, which would later be known as the Jacob Wetterling Crimes Against Children and Sexually Violent Offender Registration Act, passed by Congress and signed by President Bill Clinton in 1994. Given that whomever kidnapped Jacob had likely attempted similar offenses before, a national registry for violent sexual offenders who target children seemed like, in hindsight, would have been pretty helpful in narrowing down a suspect pool. If you've never heard of the Jacob Wetterling Act, you may recognize what it would be amended to become, which was Megan's Law. And eventually, it would become the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, named after two additional children who were abducted, sexually assaulted, and murdered. Although there is discourse to be had about the efficacy of national registries for sex offenders and child predators, in the name of Jacob Wetterling, his family was able to successfully safeguard other children in the United States by passing this legislation, and ensuring that each state within the United States was then mandated to have a registry of individuals who were likely to commit crimes similar to the one that their son was a victim of. While the years passed and the community effectively conceded that Jacob was likely deceased, his parents continued to fight to legislate child protection against predators, as well as fight to keep the good faith that Jacob was still alive. They held vigils and urged the community to continue keeping their porch lights on in case of his safe return, especially on the anniversary of his disappearance, year after year. Small-scale searches and menial work continued to be conducted by the Stearns County Sheriff's Office as well as the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the FBI, but over the years, even still, the only thing of note was that in 2010, these agencies sent out some officers to search a farm which sat at the other end of the driveway where Jacob was abducted, but ultimately turned up empty-handed. There was no other avenues left to investigate. By this time, Jacob had long been presumed deceased, and the community had been left hanging by a thread. There was nothing. There was no answers. That was until 2014, when that year and the next, 2015, over 20 years after Jacob had disappeared, the Stearns County Sheriff's Office, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and the FBI collectively decided to conduct a full cold case review of Jacob Wetterling's disappearance, hoping to uncover new leads and other avenues of investigation, with a fresh set of eyes and a renewed interest in certain connections. Part of this review included the re-examination of DNA evidence collected from potential persons of interest who had been interviewed all those years prior. If you recall, by November, police had already conducted over 100. But this time, what police wanted to examine was the DNA evidence that was collected during those interviews. Simultaneously, in an article by All That Is Interesting that I read, an amateur online sleuth by the name of Joy Baker had already been interested in that same list of persons of interest that police had interviewed all those years prior. According to that article, Joy's interest particularly piqued at the name Jared Schreel. But in her mind, this was not a suspect. Jared was another victim, likely of the same perpetrator. Approximately 9 months before Jacob Wetterling was abducted, on January 13, 1989, 12-year-old Jared Schreel was abducted and sexually assaulted in Cold Springs, Minnesota, less than an hour away from St. Joseph, where Jacob was abducted. The man who kidnapped and assaulted Jared had a very similar modus operandi to that of Jacob Wetterling's perpetrator. According to police reports, this man who attacked Jared emerged from seemingly nowhere, approached Jared with a gun, and upon releasing him, told Jared to run away and continue running without looking back as far as he could possibly go, or else he would shoot. Of course, the parallels are obvious in hindsight, and Joy's own sleuthing seemed to trigger a renewed interest in Jacob's case as a result. She would go on to sit in on CNN interviews with Jared in 2014, insisting that the likelihood that Jared and Jacob's attacker was the same person was very, very high. Then comes the tri-agency cold case review, when police come across old speculation about connections between Jared and Jacob's case, where previous enforcement officers had already long drawn the same conclusions that Joy had, but had nothing to work with in terms of pursuing a lead. As a result, investigators confirmed publicly during the cold case review that they were taking a look at previous cases of a similar nature, including a series of attacks on teenage boys occurring in the years prior to Jacob's abduction. During the review, police came across a file of a man who was interviewed in relation to the Jacob Wetterling case back in December of 1989, 52-year-old Danny Heinrich. Daniel Heinrich was listed as a person of interest in Jacob's case back in October of 89, and had been questioned then in December. According to unsealed investigative memos, the basis for his suspicion, if you'll recall I mentioned this earlier in the episode, was on account of those tire tracks that were found nearby the scene, as well as a shoe print that was uncovered. As an aside, I'll have all of these investigative memos linked on my website at crimopediapod.ca, but be warned, it's over 500 pages of documents, and unfortunately most of them are still heavily redacted. But anyways, I did go through them, and on the basis of the tire tracks and print, Daniel Heinrich was brought in for his interview in December, and despite having no alibi for the night of Jacob's disappearance and having his tire tracks and shoe print present at the scene, he was not held for very long or questioned further. Unfortunately, at the time, it seemed police's hands were tied. All they had was circumstantial, but they did take a DNA sample from him, which brings us back again to the cold case review, because when Daniel Heinrich's DNA was re-examined in 2015, it was a match to evidence collected from the abduction and sexual assault of 12-year-old Jared Schreel. Police had finally gotten a hit with a connection that made sense. However, unfortunately, the statute of limitations had expired on the crimes committed against Jared, and so Daniel Heinrich could not be arrested or charged for that case, even if they had DNA evidence against him, or even if just to hold him while they tried to get a confession for Jacob's likely murder. What they could do with this match, though, was use it to secure a search warrant of his property, which is exactly what they did. A search warrant was executed on Heinrich's home on October 28th of 2015, where police reportedly found approximately 150 images of child pornography in his possession, prompting a very swift arrest. Now, with Heinrich in custody, police immediately hatched a plan to secure a confession for Jacob Wetterling's likely murder, believing that the man who assaulted Jared was the same who kidnapped and likely murdered Jacob Wetterling, and that they had their guy in custody, finally, after all these years. After his arrest, Heinrich was questioned a second time about his whereabouts on the night of Jacob Wetterling's disappearance, and although initially he wouldn't budge, it was when police offered him a plea bargain related to the child pornography charges that they were able to get some answers. Then, on September 1st of 2016, 27 years after Jacob had disappeared, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension was led to the location of where they could recover Jacob Wetterling's remains. Jacob and his clothes were located in a pasture nearby the small town of Painesville, approximately 30 miles or 48 kilometers from where he was abducted. The remains were promptly tested and confirmed via dental records by the Ramsey County Medical Examiner's Office and a forensic dentist to be belonging to Jacob Wetterling. This was undoubtedly significant news, but when it was announced to the community that Jacob's killer was in custody, the entire nation was still yearning for any further crumbs of information they could possibly get about what happened to Jacob. Those pieces of information would come, but in the meantime, the Wetterlings grieved, the same as if they had just lost their boy yesterday, with Patty only able to muster up one quote to the media. Quote, "All I can confirm is that Jacob has been found and our hearts are broken. I'm not responding to any media yet, as I have no words." In addition to elucidating the location of Jacob's remains, as part of Daniel Heinrich's plea bargain, he was to plead guilty to one count of the 25 federal child pornography charges being brought against him, and he was to agree to testify as to the details of Jacob Wetterling's abduction in a court of law. At a hearing that was overseen by Judge John Thunheim of the United States District Court for the District of Minnesota, Daniel Heinrich testified that he kidnapped and handcuffed Jacob Wetterling before putting him in his car and driving him to a gravel pit near Painesville. Daniel admitted to sexually assaulting Jacob before killing him and burying his body there. As I had mentioned, during his confession in front of a court of law is where the harrowing details of Jacob's last moments emerged, including Daniel describing how Jacob cried and asked, quote, "What did I do wrong?" Heinrich also described how after the assault, Jacob said he was cold, and so Daniel told Jacob to get dressed, and when he did so, Jacob asked if he was being taken home, to which Daniel replied, quote, "I can't take you home," and Jacob started to cry. Heinrich testified that he was able to avoid police's instant and vast searches of the area being undertaken for Jacob by listening to a police scanner. However, it was at some point during the assault or the aftermath of it where a patrol car with lights and sirens caused Heinrich to panic and pull out his revolver, which he admitted that during the abduction of Jacob and intimidating the boys was never actually loaded. Heinrich said it was at this time that he put two rounds in his gun and told Jacob to turn around. When Heinrich put the gun to the back of Jacob's head and attempted to pull the trigger, it did not fire. But when he tried again, Jacob fell. Daniel Heinrich then left Jacob's body, returning home for a few hours, and then returning to the site to bury Jacob, eventually having to return once again a year later to move his body after noticing that his jacket had begun to emerge from the ground. It was evident to the court that Daniel Heinrich's actions were intentional, they were planned, they were insidious, and they were horrifying, both in a vacuum and as a repeat offender. As it was during this same hearing where he admitted to committing those sex crimes against Jared Schreel, confirming what Joy and, frankly, the police had suspected all along, that these crimes were all connected. In exchange for Daniel Heinrich's plea, prosecutors agreed not to charge him with the murder of Jacob Wetterling. Although a frustrating agreement on the surface, he was already effectively being incarcerated for life. At 52 years old, he was being handed the maximum sentence for the single child pornography charge, which was 20 years, and the plea allowed the state authorities to seek his civil commitment as a sexual predator at the end of his sentence, which would likely prevent him from ever being free. According to the United States Attorney Andrew Lugar, who oversaw some of the case, this was the only way really to secure closure for the murder of Jacob Wetterling. Quote, "He's not getting away with anything. We got the truth, and the Wetterling family can bring him home." During his sentencing, Judge Thunheim said, quote, "We won't pretend that this crime and sentence is about child pornography. It is also about changing the lives of so many children and parents who prayed for Jacob's return and also feared you coming out of the dark. Every child knows the story of Jacob Wetterling. You stole the innocence of children in small towns, in cities of Minnesota, and beyond." It would come out later in the media that Daniel Heinrich had an extensive criminal history, including drinking and driving beginning at 19 years old, and one involving him blowing twice over the legal limit one time in 1986. During this incident, he tried to run away from the arresting officer and punched and kicked him to try and get away. A few years later, he'd be charged for breaking and entering, and could never really seem to stay out of trouble, only escalating as time went on. This is important to note, because although Heinrich could be released technically in 17 years from the start of his prison sentence instead of 20, Judge Thunheim told him during his sentence that it was unlikely, quote, "as this crime is so heinous, so brutal, and so awful, that it is unlikely society will ever let you go free." After Jacob Wetterling's abduction and murder, his parents, Patty and Jerry, formed the Jacob Wetterling Foundation, which is an advocacy group for children's safety, and a continuation of all that they have done to legislate child protection in the United States. Because of their commitment to their cause, Jacob's legacy lives on in child protection. Megan's Law and Adam Walsh's Act are both iterations of the Jacob Wetterling Act that include more safeguarding, more oversight, and more accountability to law enforcement to keep children safe from people like Heinrich. I'll have information about the Jacob Wetterling Foundation linked on my website at crimopediapod.ca, and I highly recommend you go and check them out, as well as all the other sources I used for this episode on the same website. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Crimopedia podcast. The case of Jacob Wetterling is a very big one, and one that it's impossible to capture in one episode. However, I thought it was an important story to tell, as the Wetterlings were able to turn their anguish into action in a very meaningful way that's positively impacted the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. Again, if you'd like to read more about the Jacob Wetterling Foundation or anything that the family has done since, you can find that information on my website at crimopediapod.ca. You can also find me on Instagram at crimopediapod if you just want to talk about the case, or maybe suggest another one to me that you'd like to hear. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed making it for you. And until the next one, stay safe, and I'll see you then.